Welcome in. Welcome into the Bite Me podcast. And this week we have very special, pretty special, pretty funny. And you're going to probably get a good hint of why it's like herding cats with these guys. We are at the Houston Fishing Show. Last week we recorded the podcast there live with your questions. And even on Valentine's Day, a lot of folks showed up and got it done for us. The crew was all there, Captain Scott, Captain Dean, and Captain Caleb McCumber as well. If you didn't get to the fishing show, it was a great event. So thanks to all the fine folks out there that had us. And of course, we had our Q&A, seminar, whatever you want to call it. But right now, let's get right to it live from the Houston Fishing Show. It was the Bite Me podcast. Enjoy. And of course, we're going to be back live on YouTube next week. So you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You'll see the link on the Bite Me group page. Don't forget the Bite Me group page. And of course, don't forget the most important thing, subscribe to the podcast and you'll get notifications and you'll be able to hear the podcast at your discretion, wherever you are on the way to the ramp, whatever it may be. Just subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, all of it. You can subscribe there. We enjoyed doing this. It was great hanging out with all our friends at the Bite Me, at the Houston Fishing Show. And even better was seeing all the faces, many of the faces that listen to us every week right here on the podcast. So let's get right to it.
So you should know them, but just real quick introductions from all three captains. Pass them the microphone. You're going to have to use both at one point.
Captain Scott Null, I fish Port O'Connor. I do shallow water fishing for redfish on a poling skiff. I do tarpon on the beachfront. Going to get into doing a little wade fishing this year, I think, on the big boat. I got two different boats, run a general 26-foot cat and a little Sabine poling skiff. Been down there for quite a while and been guiding almost 20 years now.
Would you like to introduce me?
I would. Captain Dean Thomas, I fish in Aransas Pass, Texas, Redfish Bay, everything between Rockport, Port Aransas, Ingleside, all of those areas, even into Corpus Christi Bay a little bit. Been guiding down there for 22 years, kayak fishing, guiding from the skiff, drifting, some of those beautiful ultra shallow grass flats. We just have endless opportunity for sight casting, tailing reds and speckled trout, and appreciate seeing everybody, podcast fans out here today.
I'm Captain Caleb. I fix speakers. I support people that have been fishing since Columbus showed up in his boat.
All right. All right. Like I said, this is going to be all Q&A. And let's get started. I'm going to start with just some leftovers from yesterday's podcast. Just one to get everybody warmed up here. We always have leftovers because these guys like to dig in on the topics, and I like that. All right. So this was a question that was a follow-up. This is a very good way to get into it, and then we'll get into some fishing tactics, get very specific with these guys. That's why they're here. Actually, Caleb, I'm going to start with you, and you can just pass it down. Whoever wants to answer. The new limits, slot limits, bag limits, et cetera, we talked about it on the podcast 2 weeks ago. They come into effect in September, I believe, in March. So they come into effect in March. And the question becomes, the 30-inch, the question that I got was, it's a 30-inch minimum for the outside of the slot, 15 to 20. Do you ever see that changing? Would you want it to change?
If it's 28 or 30, it's not worth eating in the first place, right? But I don't know if they'll change it. I don't think they will. I don't know. I mean, to be perfectly honest, in my opinion, without offending anyone who thinks differently from my point of view, but also by looking at this matter in a different perspective and without being condemning to one's views, and by trying to make it objectified and considering each and everyone's valid opinion, I forgot what I was going to say.
I'm going to go on the record as totally agreeing with Caleb.
Come on now.
Now, the limits, the changes are very interesting. The limits that are set to change are a little smaller than I expected. I mean, I really, I'm not disappointed, but the 30-inch limit specifically, I think, is great. I mean, it's for the higher end chance to keep a trophy trout for that one fish of a lifetime. If you did want to keep that fish and you did want to make a skin mount, I mean, that's a good range to set it at. That probably is a good benchmark to keep for a long time. It's probably what's considered by everybody as the trophy mark to really get to. That 30 is, you know, everybody's goal as the ultimate goal as speckled trout. And that one probably won't change for a long time. I mean, that number has been agreed upon by anglers for many years, that that 30-incher is where you want to get to, you know, to really proclaim, you know, that is your trophy trout. Now, the limits on the smaller fish on the keeper range, that's subject to change throughout the years based on, you know, surveys and data that's collected.
Everybody keeps asking me about that 30-inch and why we came up with that. And, you know, I was there. I got to talk to the commissioners and everything. When we were talking about 25 inches, we're talking about fish that still have breeding capacities. Once they reach 30, they're not as fertile. Their eggs don't last as well. You know, they're not as fertile to reproduce once they reach that age. And so what the biologists were telling us was that those fish, when they hit 30, 32 inches, they're nearing the end of their lifespan anyway. And so being able to keep one over 30, and honestly, out of the people out of here, who's caught an over 30 inch trout?
I was gonna ask the
same. Anybody? Got one there.
Who's caught a 10 pounder?
That's part of why we set it at 30, because we didn't really want people to keep that big fish. And the majority of people who keep a big, that catch a big fish like that, there's guys out here that walk around. I ran across John Havens a while ago. I know he's caught a bunch of them. There's quite a few people in this building that have caught a lot of fish over 30 inches, and I can almost guarantee you they have never kept one. So most people that catch an over 30 are people who really work at it and are trophy trout addicts, and they're not going to keep that fish. They respect it too much. So that's kind of why it got set there. Everybody kept saying, well, man, nobody's going to catch one that they can keep then. Well, that was kind of the point. Yeah, that's what we were looking for. I know that man that just walked in the back door there has caught an over 30-inch trout. How many over 30, Mark? Yeah, it's a bunch. What's your biggest? It was 123 when he quit counting. Yeah, that's Mark Nichols, owner of DOA. He's kind of knows big trout.
All right, guys, this is your chance. You got three of the best. Hold on a second.
No.
Okay. Mark, he wants to know where he can buy your check-it stick. Your check-it stick. All right, guys, they have fished from Florida all the way down to the very tip of Texas. This is your chance to ask a question. Well, yeah, you kind of answered that. Oh, by the way, ask your questions. I'm going to get to it. Ask your questions specific to one or two of these guys or all three of them. Do you think they will ever raise the bag limit again?
Probably not. I don't see it. Honestly, I mean, when you look at it realistically, over the last 10 years, we've gone from 1 million fishermen to 1.2 million fishermen. It's gone up 200,000. It's going to keep going up. More people want to move to the coast. It's popular. The more and more people that move to the coast, the more people we're going to have fishing. It's just a numbers game. You know, the pie is getting smaller. The actual population of our fish has gotten smaller over the years. The number of people wanting a piece of that pie has gotten bigger. The only way to make it work is to cut the pieces smaller. Was it because of the freeze just a couple of years ago? That's a big part of it, but it's also habitat loss. There's a lot of factors that go into it, and I just don't see it happening. I mean, I would love it, absolutely love to see the population go back up and this really take effect, and it's just awesome from here on out. I don't know if it's going to happen or not. The hatcheries are going to help, but John's trying to take the mic from me.
No. Go ahead.
He has a thought.
There's a lot of things to consider. I know it hurts my head when I think. Thank you for your thought-provoking question. There are a lot of issues facing the fishery. The people, the amount of boats that are out there, the performance of the boats are amazing now. People are getting into areas that were considered sanctuaries once upon a time that were never getting abused. There's not a square inch of the bay out there that people cannot get to anymore. The navigational systems and the information that gets people there allows many of those places to be exploited. And then there's water quality issues that are infringing upon the health of the bays. There are oyster reefs that are being depleted that are huge issues. So all of those factors that are threats to the ecosystem out there cause Texas Parks and Wildlife to analyze that data. And they are, I mean, I hear it from both sides. Texas Parks and Wildlife gets beat down from both sides of the argument. They're in the middle, and they have to balance that. They have to keep the people happy. They want to sell fishing licenses, but they also have to protect the habitat. So those limits are a product of a lot of data that gets gathered. There's been a lot of conversation about, you know, where does this data come from? Where is the information? If you dig into it and you follow it and you really try to educate yourself, you can find that data out there. But as far as raising those limits, there's never going to be less people. There's never going to be less development on the coast. Compare Texas to Florida. I mean, go to visit Florida and look at their shorelines where every square inch of coastal property is inhabited. There's a house on it. Where I live in Rockport and Aransas Pass, the houses that are going up by the hundreds every day. Every house has a carport with a boat under it. Every boat is going to be out there in the water, and it's a challenge for the future.
All right, all that said, let's catch some fish. All right? You want to help on a specific thing, a specific bay system. They've been everywhere. Are there any questions here? Don't be bashful. These guys can help you. They've helped me. What do you think the odds are, Caleb, I'm going to give it to you, of taking croaker off the menu, as he put it, and turning them into game fish? What are the odds?
I don't think it's great in the near future. At the end of the day, croaker is big business. It's money. It's taxes coming into the state. I don't think there's any other way to put that. In the future, maybe my kid will see that happen, but man, I don't want to sound like that guy, but it's revenue. It's straight revenue. So I personally don't see it.
We've talked about this. That's a great point. We've talked about this on the podcast. Scott and Dean probably have the most expertise with this. Catching big croaker, if it can ever get back to that, it's going to be like the glory days, because we all three remember the croaker run and how awesome it was.
The thing about the croaker is it's coming into more and more conversations. It is being spoken quite often about protecting them and bringing them back to their glory of what it was back in the day. Change is difficult. It takes time. It is a slow evolution. Sometimes it takes generations to change things. And the conversation with the croakers is quite interesting. You have the environmental impact, those issues of taking all of them out of the ecosystem, but you also have the economic factor. So there are people who lobby very hard to keep their dollars in the program, but the environmental side of it and the conservationist side is starting to get a little more voice on that conversation. I mean, I see it coming up more and more often of people leaning towards protecting croakers.
Mark was talking about the glory days of croaker fishing. There's a lot of young folks that are in here, and the older ones, we all know. That was what I grew up on, man. You could go down there and go sit on Texas City Dyke on a fall afternoon and just catch the hell out of these big croaker. And younger folks these days think a croaker is nothing but a bait fish. They think, it's just a bait fish. Yeah, it's just something you throw at trout. Croaker can get to 2 to 3 pounds easily, and they'll hit a gold spoon. They'll hit a soft plastic. They're just like a little redfish, and they're damn good eating. They're fantastic eating. So what my issue with the croaker thing isn't so much about the trout side of it. It's about we need to protect the croaker, because that's what gets kids involved in fishing. That's what got me started. It's got what Dean started. It got John started. That's how you get kids into fishing, is having something out there that's easy to catch, that will bite a dead shrimp on the bottom and is still good to eat.
And that's one thing to think about when you're looking at the back and forth on social media or whatever, is there's a lot of out there about, you know, the state doesn't care about us. They're making it worse for us. you know, my original statement about the croaker is income and money. So are fishing licenses. So if they're making a move to reduce the limits, they're making a move to sustain the fishery and sell more fishing licenses and keep all that going too. I mean, they aren't doing it just to be mean. They it's a business and they're trying to run it.
Yes, ma'am. I think that's, well, I'll let them talk. Scott? Fish consumption advisories. Are you buying that? How much have you eaten?
No, they haven't lifted those for the Galveston area. Also down there where I am in Port O'Connor, we had some real serious problems with some heavy metals in the Port Lavaca area. And yeah, I don't see them lifting all that. And the biggest problem is all those heavy metals settle to the bottom of the bay, and then they do the dredging, brings it right back up to the top. It's back into the water column. That's why, I don't know how many of y'all out there like oysters. That's why I would never eat a damn oyster anywhere around here. Because what are they? They're filter feeders. Our water's not great, man. And they're filtering it out, and then you eat them? That's not for me.
Yep. And, you know, once upon a time, back in the day, 40, 50, 60 years ago, they were just pouring those stuff into the bay. And those areas like Upper Trinity Bay, Port Lavaca, and those places, just like Scott said, those heavy metals never go away. They are going to be there for eternity. And they catch fish in those areas, and they test their tissue, and they detect those heavy metals in their tissue, which is where those things come from. And, you know, those have been in place for many years, and that's probably not going to change in our kids' lifetime.
This is for Caleb. This is a good one. East or West Matagorda? This is just a general, where would you fish? What do you see type question.
East or West Matagorda, it's very simple. Do you want to catch a lot of fish or you want to catch a big fish? They are two totally different bay systems. One's going to be a sandier, harder bottom with grass. The other's going to be muddy mud with shell. The Colorado River it splits Texas in half right there. You start from the Rockport stuff towards west, and then east you're going to Galveston. Guiding-wise, if somebody tells me I want to just catch a bunch of fish and have a good time, we're going to West Bay. If somebody tells me I want to target a trophy big fish and I'm okay with not catching as many fish, it's East Bay. Bunch of redfish, West Bay. You know, some bigger, better fish, East Bay. I don't know how many times I've been in West Bay and told my customer, congratulations, you caught a grand slam. It's a little league grand slam, but you caught one. Because for the most part, they're smaller. I've seen maybe two or three fish over 29 inches regarding trout in West Bay versus East Bay. You know, the numbers are much better there. But if you want to have a good time, and the waiting on you is much easier in West Bay. It's easy to pick out the guts. It's easy to move around. It's easier to see the sandbars when you're running your boat. You know, the only drawback to West Bay, unless you go all the way down to Mad Island Cut, is kind of tricky to get into it. Other than that, to me, West Bay is your good time, pretty water stuff. East Bay is, I want to grind it out and be miserable and tell my friends about it.
Yes, ma'am. We have the Bite Me hats. It's at scottnullphotography.com. We have hats, shirts, scottnullphotography.com, hats, shirts, and the little gators and stickers. We all have stickers on our boat, etc. Go ahead. I'm sensing a theme here. Back to the croaker. Let's go. I see what you're saying. In other words, we're going to a smaller limit, basically, because we're limiting the number of fish you can keep. By default, that's going to limit the number of croakers sold. I also think it might tie in, and maybe one of you two or three can answer this, like the more that you fish with a three limit, maybe the more momentum turning croaker into a game fish happens.
What I'm hoping to see is that guys that throw croaker, they catch their three fish limit, and then they start throwing lures afterwards for the challenge of it. Maybe that'll help. I don't know that that's really going to work, but the reason I wanted to grab the mic, at the fishing center just this past summer, limit's five, right? Two dudes roll up in an SCB that's got all everything on it. I mean, it is, this son of a gun is decked out. three rods apiece on either side, three Waterloo rods. They got the high-end Shimano reels. They got, they are dressed, they should be in a magazine. They are dressed perfectly. They step out, and I hear them, I'm waiting on my customers, and I overhear them say, what do you think, six dozen? Why don't we go ahead and get eight? We ran out last week. It's two dudes. It's a five fish limit. They got eight dozen croakers to go catch five fish. Either they really suck at this, or I don't know, or they just kept catching them after it just because they could. I don't know. But I don't know that the mentality is going to change.
All right, devil's advocate here. And to be very clear about all of it, if you were on Too Cool in 2011 and there was a croaker argument, there was about seven usernames coming at you, and I was all seven of them. I could argue with myself. I could agree with myself, and I was really against it. That being said, I have been out to throw croaker once or twice, and it is incredibly possible to catch and release on a croaker. You can, if you're using the circle hook and you get the thump and do what you're supposed to do, you can hook them right in the corner of the mouth, pull them up, and let them go. Arguably less harmed than on a corky or a topwater. The trouble is, and I was about that. I went out one morning, we caught 125 trout. There's a big name walking around out here, and it was me and him. And of those 125 trout, we released them. And I was all about, I was crazy. The croaker stuff doesn't hurt anybody until about a week later, when somebody told me the key to a croaker is when you feel the thump, you open the bell and let them run about 15 seconds and then set the hook to make sure you don't lose them. So a couple of guys could very easily go out and use eight dozen to catch their five fish and catch and release if they're doing it appropriately, which is the term that I've used on Bite Me several times, in that, you know, when it comes to gun control stuff, the gun isn't what dangerous, the user is what it is. And it's pretty well the same thing with croaker.
All right, let's get into your bait systems here specifically. He talked about East and West Matagorda. I want you to do the same thing, and then y'all, we'll get back to your questions. Basically, Aransas Bay, Aransas Pass, you know, Redfish Bay, all that stuff. What he talked about, what do you expect, what do you see, how do you fish it?
Well, I wasn't actually listening when Caleb was talking, but I will kind of take off with my own thought process on that. Aransas Pass, where I fish, is it is not marsh. It is not what you expect to see up on the northern coast. It is saltwater flats. We don't have rivers that run into our bay system. So it is vast, endless, ultra shallow grass flats, crystal clear water. I mean, even when our wind blows 20 and 30 miles an hour, it stays crystal clear because of the grass and the sand that is there. There's no mud to get churned up. So we have excellent sight casting opportunities, spotting the fish that you're actually casting to. And it goes on for miles. I mean, so you have the areas in front of Rockport, and even if you want to go a little further than that to St. Charles Bay around Goose Island. But Goose Island in that area, like St. Charles Bay and Mesquite Bay and stuff, is a very dividing line to where things really change. North of there, it's very marsh-like, and it does get dirty. It gets churned up when it's windy. South of there, it really starts in Redfish Bay, where there's mangroves, lush grass flats, and then you move beyond Corpus Christi Bay to the Laguna Madre, even to down south. It just gets more tropical as you go in that direction. So we have from Aransas Pass to Rockport to Port Aransas to Ingleside, which is a pretty vast area. I mean, you can spend your whole life in that little triangle and, you know, you can not see all of it, not explore all of it, not really fish it. You can get focused on small areas. You can have a great time there. And then beyond that, you have St. Joe Island and Mud Island, and then the backside of Cedar Bayou, which is all within range of where we launch in Aransas Pass. You're talking at the longest, you know, 45-minute to one-hour boat ride. And Caleb came down and fished with me, and he actually commented
on, I mean, we ran 5 minutes from the marina and started fishing and we're catching fish. And he kind of commented that that's just not the way it is in Matagorda, where they launch and they run many, many miles to get to where they're going to fish. So we just have an amazing amount of opportunity that's quick and easy. It's really tropical environment, a beautiful place to sight cast. And it's been a really good time for me for 20 years.
And if Dean inspires any of y'all to go to St. Charles Bay and you're trolling along an edge and you find a 5-blade Mercury prop, let me know, because my partner would really like to have it back.
I'm sure he lost that for his partner. Had to figure that one out. That was a tough question. I'm in Port O'Connor, and I had my choice when I was retiring from the police department up here. I was fishing Galveston, guiding Galveston. And once I retired and the kids got out of school, we talked about where to go, and we started to go down there, Aransas Pass, where he is. That was a little too far for my wife with the grandkids being up this way, so we decided on Port O'Connor. But Port O'Connor's got a little bit of everything. It's got what Caleb was talking about with West Matagorda Bay. I can go over there and fish on those coves. I can get over there on the island in Espiritu Santo. I almost said it wrong. But, all the back lakes over there, everybody's heard of Pringle, but there's a dozen others that are named that most people don't ever get to further back in there. So we've got a marsh area like that. We've got back lakes. We got the mangroves we're used to before the freeze. We got some coming back. We've got deep water. Then also, I've got the jetties right there really close. And then outside the jetties, everybody here knows I talk about tarpon a lot. The tarpon, for whatever reason, like that area. I think it's because we have Pascavallo as well as the jetties. And so we have a lot of tarpon that stay there throughout the summer. So it gives me a lot of options. I can go trout fishing. I can go out and go poling for redfish. I can go fish deep at the jetties for redfish. I can go chase bull reds. I can run the beachfront and go catch tarpon. It was just a place for me to go to spend the rest of my life. I wanted some variety. I don't want to get bored.
All right. Any other questions from anybody? Yes, sir. It's a good question. Y'all heard most of that. Releasing, handling fish, given the new, we're all going to catch, hopefully, a bunch of over 20 fish. A lot of our listeners, as he pointed out, may be new to this. And I'm going to start with Dean on this one. What would you say, just soup to nuts?
You threw me off a little bit there. Whenever we're catching fish and we intend to release, whenever I know that fish is coming in and there are intentions to let that fish go, it is handled very gently and quickly. Of course, we want to get the picture. We want to save that moment for the people that are catching it. But with a speckled trout, and also, you know, the nets are very important. You know, if you have a rubber-coated net, they're very easy on the slime. The nets that are the knotted up twine, they do, when the trout goes in that net, you can actually see the scratches on their body. And there's even when you're fighting a fish, if the line wraps around them, and when they come in with a speckled trout, I mean, you can plainly see where that line went across their body. But you don't want to hold them up by their jaw. You don't want to hang them up in the air. If a fish is going to get released, you know, I might put a boga grip on it to land it and hold it in the water, but we'll never hold it up in the air. To take the picture, we take the boga off, we put two hands underneath that fish and quickly get it back in the water as soon as possible. With redfish, they're very durable. I mean, redfish, you can put them in the cooler for 10 minutes and then you can turn them back to the water and they swim away. I've seen people have second thoughts, and they're just really tough. But a speckled trout that's going to be released, keep it in the water, touch it with wet hands, don't put a towel on it, don't hang it up in the air.
I don't know. I've had, over the years, I've probably had 6 or 8 customers that have a picture of them holding a 30-inch trout, and their picture sucks because after about 45 seconds of me telling them, show me, roll it to me a little bit, do this, do that, If they're not executing it, that fish is going back in the water. That's where I see trout struggle the most, is whenever you have them out too long. In colder water, they do better. But when the water's hot, they're already weak by the time you get them landed, and you have X amount of time to get it done. get them back in the water, and then I will actually support that fish. I've done it for 5 or 6 minutes before, where I'm supporting that fish. I'm moving his tail back and forth, and I'm kind of dragging him back and forth a little bit. Not enough to really jam water into his gills, but just to get it moving back and forth. And after a while, I'll feel her start to kick, and I usually don't let her go on the first or second kick. I wait till I feel a stronger one to get her out of there. Redfish, handle them with care, Dean. Don't put it in the cooler in the first place, Dean. But redfish are tougher. I've never in my life been fishing for in a school and boat flip like four and then go, well, I guess we can turn them loose now. And they didn't totally swim off fine. But redfish, they're cooler. They're not tougher. They're cooler.
Yeah. You can beat them with a stick.
You cannot beat them with a stick and then let them go.
That's one of the things I see at the jetties all the time. People catching the little bitty trout, and they catch them, and they go, boom, and they throw them like a grenade. I have never figured out why people do that.
Oh, that's a big question that we haven't talked about. Cedar Bayou, opening it up, has it helped with everything from bait to fishing, I'm guessing?
Cedar Bayou is a touchy subject with a lot of people. Yes, it's much better when it's open. And it gives another outlet for San Antonio Bay when San Antonio Bay goes fresh. Anytime you get a flood in Austin, anywhere along the Quad, it's going to come into San Antonio Bay. The only way it goes out is out through Port O'Connor, and it'll freshen up so much, and it takes so long. Having Cedar Bayou is another outlet, but it also allows saltwater to come in, good fresh seawater to come in. Do I feel like it has made a difference? Yes. I mean, there's scientific studies that show that it was making a difference. As soon as it opened up, they were doing some seine netting, and they're finding juvenile redfish that were being sucked in, you know, because our redfish, they breed on the beachfront around passes. That the babies come in on the flood tide. So they started seining around there, and they found that, yes, it was going to repopulate real well. Unfortunately, it started closing up again. I don't know the status of it right now. Hanging on my wall in my office is a CCA picture of aerial shot of it right before they started working on it, and then one on the day that they opened it up. It's a really cool photo. I just don't know the exact status of it today. I know it was closing back up, and there was talks about doing some maintenance work on it. I don't know where they're at. One of the biggest problems is they can't do the work when the whooping cranes are here. So when the whooping cranes are down, they won't let them work on any of it. That's also why everybody says, well, why don't they put a jetty on it? It'll keep it open. That's one of the Corps of Engineers things is they will not let them put the jetties in because it has some effect on the whooping cranes, and I don't quite understand that. I'm not the there's a biologist right here. He might know more about it, but I don't know how that would affect them to put a jetty in there.
Interesting conversation on Cedar Bayou. Years of experimentation on dredging and the challenges of keeping it open. And yes, scientifically, it has been proven that it is great for the bay system. The reason that it closes is there is hydraulic pressure created by water that flows from the bays into the Gulf. Naturally, it was a pass. Naturally, it stayed open. But whenever you don't have freshwater inflows that are flowing into the bays, as all of that water is being used upriver and it is not making it to the bays, it doesn't keep those passes open. Even Fish Pass in Corpus Christi, it has jetties. It had been opened in the past. It wouldn't stay open either due to the lack of water, fresh water that flows into the bays. So it's hydraulic pressure in the bays, the constant flow. And historically, 100 years ago, there were hundreds of passes up and down. The Newport Pass towards, the pass, it's called the Pass of 1848 or something like that, from Port Aransas. There were actually two passes at the Port Aransas area, and all of those have silted in and closed over history due to the lack of water that flows into the bays. The rivers, of course, the issues are as far as San Antonio and the cities that are upriver. Every time they build a golf course and they irrigate those things, they pull more and more water. The Nueces River that flows into Corpus Christi Bay it is barely a trickle of what used to run into the bay. So there is no pressure behind that to keep those open. When they did Cedar Bayou, I went out there and I watched them dredge it. I went out there on the ceremonial day whenever they pulled the last bucket of sand and it started flowing and it stayed open for a couple years. Hurricane Harvey changed the complete picture of the shoreline and closed everything up. And that was after years of raising thousands and thousands of dollars by volunteer organizations to get that open, and then it was closed in one day, and it's time to start the process all over again.
I thought I wanted to say something, and then Scott intimidated me at the biologist, and then you start using words like hydraulic pressure. Just about any time a pass is open, is you could, if it's been closed and they open it, you can consider it has made everything better. One of my favorite fisheries relies on the San Bernard being open. When the San Bernard is open, then Cedar Lakes, Caltrap, all the stuff in the San Bernard River can be really good. Now that the San Bernard is closed, I've watched all that fishery dwindle and go away. When they open it again, it'll be good because the fish can come in and out. And whenever it silts up, it's going to go up and down. So any time that a pass has been open, just consider that's probably something worth looking at.
Will they ever open Parker's Cut?
The cut through from West Bay to the river? Man, I don't know. I think it's one of those things. It's the same way as they've got everything going the way it's working now. Just like I've been on the west end of East Bay a million times. And like, man, why don't we have a cut where we can drive right here and be in the harbor? When they do that, there's no telling what else is going to affect around there. What he's talking about, the east end of Matagorda West Bay, and that end is already it's kind of shallow and hard to get around in. So what's gonna happen whenever they open Parker's Cut up? I wasn't even around when Parker's Cut was open. It sounds like the glory days to me. I have been all the way to the end of Parker's Cut and fished it many times, but I'm not in the Army Corps of Engineers. I can't grasp what would happen if they opened that influx from the Colorado River into Matagorda West Bay. I don't know if that would mess up how the diversion channel works. I don't know any of that. It'd be cool if they did, but I'm not qualified to answer that one at all.
Parker's Cut was closed because it had an issue with silting in the pass. So due to keeping the jetties clean and keeping the river open is why that levee was built. And more than likely, that's not going to be undone due to the fact that the Colorado River does not flow at the potential that it used to. And then those big floods and those things that come through, I mean, they bring trees, they bring tons of mud, they bring millions of pounds of dirt from upriver, and it settles in those areas. So without a continuous flow, it will silt in. And I'm not sure what year it was, 70s, somewhere back in the day, that levee was built and they closed that to keep the river open.
And this is why I hang out with elders. They know these things. I can say this out loud right here and be pretty safe, but it is going on the podcast. Maybe I'm going to get called out. Maybe I won't. But my limited research and listening to elders, East Matagorda Bay wasn't even formed till the early 1900s because of all the silt coming out of the Colorado and ended up closing that off. So I think you're right, Elder.
Yes, sir. Where, when, and why? Do you know what a catch five is?
Whoop. Mirror lure catch five. I haven't thrown them a whole lot, but it's a slow sinking mullet imitation. Anytime that they're on that size mullet, if you want to meet that profile and that action, I would throw it wading, maybe waist deep water, anywhere where you have finger mullet. Probably earlier in the summer when the mullet are a little bit smaller, late spring, early summer. That'd be my guess on it. That's just not something that I throw a whole lot.
So in my area where I fish, we have the ultra shallow flats that have a distinct drop-off on the edges of it. So right now through the last couple months, we've had very low tide. So fishing up on the flats, only in the deeper indentions in those flats, has been very difficult. The only place you can do that. So we move out to the edges of the drop-offs. And that catch five or any slow sinking type of lure like that is going to be great on those drop-offs. So we park out in about 5 or 6 feet of water, and we throw up to the grass beds and we work them down those drop-offs. And in the summertime, those are classic speckled trout spots. I mean, the trout just swarm along those edges, and it would be a great option for those.
A third 30-inch trout came on a catch five. It was February. It had been cold. There was a warming trend. I was down in Baffin. The warming trend was happening, so the mullet were starting to come to the top and kind of mill around. They weren't real erratic and fast by any means, but they were just kind of moving around. And I was throwing that thing and letting it sink about 8 to 10 inches and then just slow twitching it back to me and trying to match what those mullet were doing. I started seeing some shad moving around, or not really shad, but a smaller bait fish moving around, where it let me know the trout were getting going. And I it was the beginning of a major, and I just started kind of matching what those mullet were doing with that catch five. And it's a cool lure because it does sink slow, but I could work it slow.
All right, we got about 2 or 3 minutes here. I'm gonna end it with this, and we'll get to your questions individually too. You can talk to these guys, because you talked about big trout. We want to catch a big trout, and it got me thinking a little bit. If you had to go out, each one of you, just pass it down. I think you're going to be throwing a cork in. I want you to talk about why. You had to catch a big trout tomorrow.
What if I have to catch a big trout tomorrow? If I had to catch a big trout tomorrow, it's February. Again, I'm gonna try to find a depression with some mud and some bait in it. But my go-to is I'm gonna throw the Corky Fat Boy, even though I have a pocket of new exciting things here, and I'm wherever I can find some bait work, and that Corky is just gonna be slow rolling. But the whole if you think you're working it slower, I think that's crap. I just want that little dude to wobble back and forth, but I'm going to try different water columns of it. I might, if there's no grass, I might be kind of dragging along the bottom, and the next time I may work it a little bit faster to keep it 6 inches off the bottom. And the next time I might try to bring it up some more and some more and some more. But February, I'm looking for just a cove with some bait in it. And like we talked about on the show the other day, I might sit there for 6 hours trying to make it happen. So if I had to go catch a big fish tomorrow, rather than working it slower and slower and slower, I'm just going to try different water columns, different presentations.
Big trout in Redfish Bay at this time of year are going to be right on the sandbars adjacent to deeper water. You get the days whenever the sun comes out, and they're going to move right up into the edge. But it is very clear those fish are very hard to sneak up on. A lot of times when you see them, they're going away from you because they either saw or felt you. But sandbars that are very shallow, that are being warmed up by the sun, that are adjacent to deep water drop-offs, is where you're going to find those fish right now. I'm throwing soft plastics, weedless rigs that'll sit on the bottom and just bounce across the bottom right in front of their face. And blind casting is very tough this time of year. I mean, where we're at, you're going to be patient, you're going to go slow and try to spot those fish.
One of my biggest trout came this time of year on a topwater, and it was conditions I went ahead and researched while y'all were yabbering. Water temperature is like 60, 62. We're going to have overcast, getting ready to have a front coming in. The water levels are going way up. They've been super low. They're rising. I would venture to say that those trout are going to ease up onto some flat, and they're going to be fairly shallow because we've got 60-something degree water and 70-degree air temperatures. And I would probably, my biggest one came on a big topwater. It was a big full-size spook. And just kind of lollygagging along. I was catching redfish, and the reds weren't real enthusiastic. And I was just working along, playing around, catching my reds that whenever they would blow up. And all of a sudden, I had a huge trout on. My buddy knocked it off with a net. But, I still got a problem with that. But, yeah, a big topwater worked kind of slow. Would be my way of going about it. I just don't like throwing corkies. I've never been a big fan.
All right, they haven't thrown us out yet. So you had a question. We'll go ahead and answer yours. Your hand was up first. All right, this is a good question to end it on, because it's three different answers, I believe. Talking about deep water to shallow water. What exactly is deep water? What exactly is shallow water?
Yeah, great question, because a lot of times when we're drifting along and I tell people it's going to get deeper, and at the end of the day they're like, Dean, I never saw any deep water today. So on the flats, on the normal day when we're drifting on the sand holes, we're in about 1 foot to 18 inches of water. And deep in those areas is going to go down to maybe 3 feet of water in the deepest spots. The edges of the drop-offs that I speak of, where you hit the sandbars and the deeper water off of there, is going to be like 4 to 6 feet at the deepest. So we'll park in about 4 feet of water, cast up to those edges, and then work it back down into about the 4 foot range.
It's all relative to where you're at. If I'm fishing the Colorado River, it's the deep spot's 24 feet. If I'm fishing a back lake, the deep spot's 3 feet. It's relative to what's around you. I was riding with Chuck McKinney down towards Summer House and Nine Mile and everything this fall, and we're running in like 2 inches of water, and I'm just kind of grabbing the handle, and he's telling me, he says, hey, if you ever get in a bind down here, right up here is a deep spot. You just make it over there, and you can jump right out. And I see this spot coming. I'm like, oh, no. And I start bracing up. Like, and that spot, it looked terrible to me. It was 3 inches deep, but it had a softer bottom. So it's all completely relative to where, to what's around you, right? I mean, in Mitchell's Cut, I think there's a hole that's like, is it 20 feet deep? But the entirety of Mitchell's Cut's what, 12, 13? So it's just relative to what the habitat is around them.
Yeah, along those lines, I used to fish Port Mansfield quite a bit. And there were days when we'd be up there fishing in ankle-deep water, and then we would drop to knee-deep water. There was a little bit of a shelf there, and it was a drop-off, and that's where the fish were. So like he said, it's all relative to what you're fishing and what the average is around that area. I used to work with a bunch of bass guys when I worked with Costa. Everybody in my group was all bass. And I'd say something about, yeah, my fish moved deeper. And they're thinking 32, 40. How deep are they? they've dropped off from 6 or 8 inches to 3 feet. So, yeah, it is all relative. We're being told that we got to wrap it up. The boss got on us.
Hey, thank you guys very much. Bite Me Podcast, wherever you get your podcast. And these guys are fantastic. And they're going to hang around a little bit if you have any other questions.
All right. So obviously, we're not going to have the what would Scott do, what would Dean do, what would Caleb do this week. We want to keep it timely. We always like to give you guys the best advice from the captains as you get into the weekend. But the weather's going to look pretty decent. I can tell you that much right there. So I hope you guys have a fantastic weekend. Hope you enjoyed the live podcast. We'll be back with you on YouTube live next week. And of course, you can download the podcast wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to subscribe. So you guys have a great weekend. And don't forget, as I always say, catch them up, be safe. And we will talk to you next time.